ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 26th of January. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, local heroes celebrated in the Australia Day honours and thousands rally amid intense debate over the date and purpose of the National Day. Also, the clean-up begins. Queensland residents assess the damage from former tropical cyclone Kirrily as the system moves inland.
The winds were definitely very gusty last night. There was a couple of times there where we sort of stopped and looked and waited for the roof to go. But it was pretty good. We survived, so that's always a bonus.
More than 1,000 Australians have been recognised in the Australia Day Honours list. Spanning almost every field, the awards recognise distinguished and conspicuous service. A COVID honour roll is also included this year, recognising 49 Australians for the part they played in Australia's pandemic response. Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
After walking the red carpet, they were greeted with a handshake from Prime Minister Anthony Albanese.
They won't get morning tea.
For only the second time in history, the list features more women than men. One of those women is 100-year-old Lillian Rees, the oldest of this year's recipients. She watched a Ronald McDonald House be built near her home and spent the next two decades volunteering with sick kids and their families.
And I used to say to my husband, when they put the ad in the paper for volunteers, I'm going to be the first one there. And they had, and I was the first. And I said, anyone want to volunteer? I am. And I was there for over 20 years then, helping the families, and it was great because they were country people and rather scared of being in the city a bit, and you could help a little bit. Made friends I've still got today.
Social justice advocate Sophie Trevitt died last year at the age of 32 after being diagnosed with a brain tumour. Her life's work, fighting to keep First Nations children out of the criminal justice system, has seen her appointed as a member of the Order of Australia. Her partner, Tom Swan, says while Sophie would be honoured to receive the award, she would like the focus to be on her work.
Kids as young as 11, 10 can be sent to jail. And in the Northern Territory, every single kid in prison is Aboriginal. She loved those kids. She saw them as resourceful, smart, funny, and just caught on the wrong side of a bad system. Australia is unusual in locking up kids that young, and she saw it was wrong and wanted to change it. And it's a real testament to her strength of will that that we're seeing changes across the country now.
He says it's work that's left a lasting legacy.
It's because of Sophie that Spitwoods are banned in the ACT. It's because of Sophie that you're not allowed to harass people going into abortion centres in the ACT. She just had this tenacity and stubbornness, pig-headedness, you might say. When she saw something wrong, she fought to change it.
Yolngu woman Bettina Danganbar from Galawinku in East Arnhem Land is a widely respected Aboriginal community police officer and anti-domestic violence advocate.
We get to share our culture, our knowledge, our language to our other fellow officers, and we get to teach them how to approach our people. And it's very important because it builds a bridge.
She was the driving force behind the establishment of a women's safe space on the island after years of taking women at risk into her own home.
It wasn't an easy road because we had many obstacles, but it's just been amazing, and I feel very blessed for people that, you know, have recognised my hard work and dedication. But this is not just my award. It's for everybody else that has walked with me and worked with me to get this safe place up and running.
Experimental criminologist Lorraine Mazerolle has been awarded the Companion of the Order of Australia. She spent years in Australia and the United States developing evidence-based policing reforms and is a leader in her field.
My area of expertise is running really big randomised field trials, and we run different trials to test innovative policing practices. And the goal is to assess what works and what doesn't in terms of how police can work together and with the communities to better control crime problems.
It's Companion of the Order of Australia, Lorraine Mazerolle, ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. Well, while some Australians are celebrating today, others are reflecting on the survival of First Nations people. Protests and ceremonies are being held across the country to mark more than 200 years since colonisation. Rachel Hayter reports.
At Belmore Park in inner Sydney, hundreds turned out in oppressive heat to remind the country of its Aboriginal history.
After 60,000 years, we're still here and nothing's taken that away from us.
We have survived to be here today and still tell our stories and our dances and our tradition and everything. Our culture hasn't been lost, it's just been nearly forgotten, and I think it's important just to remember that.
This Maori man says the experience of Indigenous Australians has parallels around the world.
I'm actually from Aotearoa, New Zealand, so I'm here to support our black brothers and sisters. The Maori race, we signed a treaty with the Queen of England, but over here, you know, it was more or less taken away from them. All we want is simple, is love.
As well as the black, red and yellow of the Aboriginal flag, another one was flying among the crowd. The black, white, green and red flag of Palestine. One Palestinian family travelled from George's Hall in Sydney's west to express their solidarity with the Aboriginal experience. 8-year-old Amal explained why.
For the Aboriginal people, because I know how it feels to be taken their land, because people take their land away.
Another theme of this year's Invasion Day rally was last year's failed Voice to Parliament referendum.
2024 is a very peculiar year for our mob. We've just come through a referendum process which sought to recognise our people in the alien constitution.
Sylvia and Adrian from Marrickville in Sydney's inner west were disappointed with the outcome of that vote.
I suppose I'm here feeling frustrated because we supported the referendum, even though we knew it was a minimal ask.
Until we recognise our history and the consequences of our history, settler colonialism will remain at the base of Australian society.
For these men, January 26 is a painful day.
Today is not a day to celebrate. Today is a day of shame. It was an invasion. It always was an invasion.
If we want to learn how to maintain Australia, then we've got to listen to Aboriginal people.
Earlier this morning, the annual Woogalora ceremony was held at the city's Barangaroo Reserve. Woogalora means one mob. Councillor Yvonne Weldon is a Wurundjeri woman from the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Land Council. She welcomed visiting dignitaries, including the state's Premier Chris Minns and Governor Margaret Beasley.
Cruelty should not be the default. Kindness, inclusion and acceptance must be who we all are. We welcome you. We include you. Don't be a spectator to allow for me what you wouldn't accept for yourself.
Performing at this morning's ceremony was Aboriginal artist Lauren Ryan. She's from Coaldale in Tamworth in northwest New South Wales and is up for a golden guitar at the Tamworth Country Music Awards tomorrow. She sang Yilalu, which is a word from her grandfather's language, the Kamilaroi language, meaning everything is going to be okay. Yilalu. Today's protests and ceremonies demonstrating the debate around the date is not over yet.
That's Rachel Hayter reporting there. Right across the country, you're tuned into The World Today. The Albanese government's backflip on its election promise not to change the coalition's stage three tax cuts will soon be put to the test with a by-election in the federal seat of Dunkley in Victoria. Our reporter Samantha Donovan is in Dunkley and joined me a short time ago. Sam, can you tell us a bit about the Dunkley electorate?
The electorate, Sally, sits in Melbourne's outer southeastern suburbs. It takes in suburbs like Frankston, where I am now, the wealthier suburb of Mount Eliza, and suburbs like Seaford, which are very popular with young families and tradies. As the opposition leader, Peter Dutton, identified yesterday, it is an electorate that has plenty of voters in those lower and middle income brackets, and that's why Mr. Dutton thinks the government has made this tax announcement to appeal to voters in this electorate ahead of the by-election on March the 2nd.
And Sam, you've been speaking to some of the voters in Dunkley. What have they had to say about Labor's proposed changes to the Stage 3 tax cuts?
I got the impression, Sally, that there's a little bit of confusion, or people aren't really quite across the announcement as yet. When you say to them, what do you think, has the government broken an election promise? There seems to be a bit of alarm amongst people who may be in the lower and middle income bracket that the changes won't in fact benefit them. Some people seem to be unfazed by this so-called broken election promise, but I really got the impression this morning that people are just getting across the details of the announcement and trying to calculate what it means for them. This is what some of the Dunkley voters had to tell me this morning.
I think the thing for me was that if you're going to go out with such a massive promise, then you need to follow through with it.
I think he had to do something to address the cost of living, but I don't think it comes at a cost of breaking a pretty big election promise.
Well, I would love to pay less tax. You know, I'm a disability support worker. I work a lot of hours, work weekends all the time, you know, and my tax is ridiculous.
If you're paying less tax, would you want to work more hours?
Oh, definitely.
Well, you mentioned it about 100 odd times that it's not going to do it, and he does it, it's not on.
That's a voters in the federal seat of Dunkley in Victoria speaking to Samantha Donovan. Well, some North Queenslanders are surveying the damage after a wild night of weather brought by tropical cyclone Kirrily. Kirrily crossed the coast with a little less force than predicted, but there's still a big clean-up ahead. More than 60,000 properties across North Queensland have lost power. The cyclone system has been downgraded to a tropical low, but plenty of rain is expected in Kirrily's path. Rachel Mealy reports.
Townsville residents held their breath as Cyclone Kirrily passed over. Shirani Williams says there were scary moments.
The winds were definitely very gusty last night. There was a couple of times there where we sort of stopped and looked and waited for the roof to go. But it was pretty good. We survived, so that's always a bonus.
Laurel Farrell's house in Dirigan came through the storm okay, but she saw a lot of trees down on her way to work this morning at Bushland Beach.
Look, a lot of debris on the ground. We have had reports here of staff who can't come to work have got to stay and clean up. A lot of trees down, fences down, animals on the loose. Yeah.
Townsville Mayor Jenny Hill says she's still gathering information, but she's pleased to hear how everyone has come through.
At this stage, we haven't heard of any major damage. I've spoken to the police. There's been no deaths, which is the first thing I want to say, and I'm glad everyone heeded the warnings, stayed indoors. We know we had significant gusts of winds. We know that trees are down. We've lost power to more than half the community. And I believe even the hospital is working on their generation backup, as we are here at the LDC.
More than 50,000 households are without power in Townsville, and there are more power outages further south in the Burdekin. Townsville residents have been asked to conserve water while the power is out. Clean-up efforts are in full swing across the region, and attention is being paid to prevent excess debris impacting the Great Barrier Reef. Heidi Tate is the chief executive of Tangaroa Blue Foundation and lives in Airlie Beach.
What we've seen in the past with cyclones is that marine debris loads can triple from what they normally are, and marine debris can also wash up in areas that normally aren't hot spots just because of the unusual weather patterns that happen. So our first steps are going to be in assessing that once everybody is safe and it's safe to do so with access. But we never know what we're going to find washing in from overseas and offshore currents, but also that's come out of our catchments through our stormwater systems.
Kirrily has been downgraded to a tropical low, but it's still threatening to dump a lot of rain as it tracks across the state. Bureau of Meteorology senior forecaster Angus Hines says Kirrily's presence may be felt for a while yet.
Through the course of this morning, the tropical low has been moving its way into the northern goldfields and upper Flinders forecast district there in the northern interior of Queensland, and it is still bringing persistent rainfall to some of those inland areas.
QFES Acting Commissioner Stephen Smith says communities in western Queensland are prepared for the big wet.
A lot of water is still in the system, so that flooding and isolation of communities will occur right through the west and has already started to occur through those areas. Those communities have been very well prepared. They've stocked themselves up so they're equipped for some days of isolation. And, you know, that's not an unusual thing out in those communities when these types of events happen, so they're well prepared for that. But again, a lot of the time post-events, when there's a lot of water moving through systems from the event itself, this is when people get in trouble as they start to move about. So we all urge caution, and our message is very clear. If it's flooded, forget it. Don't drive or ride or play in floodwater.
That's Acting Commissioner Stephen Smith there, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Later today, the International Court of Justice will deliver an interim judgment on whether Israel's actions in Gaza amount to genocide. Israel began bombing Gaza in October after a Hamas attack on Israel killed more than 1,200 people. The Gazan Health Ministry says more than 25,000 Palestinians have been killed in the resulting Israeli bombardment and ground assault. South Africa hopes that the interim ruling could force a ceasefire, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will ignore any judgment that finds his country guilty of genocide. Angus Randall reports.
As the world waits for a ruling on whether Israel has a case to answer over accusations of genocide, Dr. Jaber Al-Sher's biggest concern is food. He works in the paediatrics department at Abu Yusuf Al-Najjar Hospital in Gaza's south.
A month and a half ago, this baby's weight was 7.5 kilos. In a month and a half, he lost nearly 2 kilos. The mother and the baby suffer from malnutrition. No milk is available, which all impacts the growth of the baby.
The World Health Organization says there's almost no food available to feed the more than 2 million people trapped in Gaza. Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says conditions are hellish.
70% of the dead are children and women. That alone is enough for a ceasefire.
In South Africa's case, brought to the International Court of Justice, it cites the high number of civilian casualties, the use of bombs in populated areas, and the denial of aid into Gaza as evidence of Israel's genocidal intent. Israel says it has a right to defend itself against Hamas, that the terrorist group embeds itself with civilians, and that its conflict is with Hamas, not the people of Gaza. The final judgment is years away, but South Africa hopes an interim ruling could force a ceasefire, allowing more aid into the war zone. Hamas official Osama Hamdan says his side will abide by the findings.
If the court in The Hague issues a ruling to ceasefire, the Hamas movement will abide by the ceasefire as long as the enemy abides by it.
The decision needs the support of 9 of the 17 judges to become legally binding. Both South Africa and Israel are signatories to the United Nations Genocide Convention, forged in the aftermath of the Holocaust. Israeli government spokesman Alon Levy denies the accusation of genocide and is confident the court will rule in his favour.
We have expected, of course, to throw out the completely absurd and ridiculous charges.
And Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says if the decision goes against Israel, he'll ignore it, and it's unlikely the UN would be able to enforce the decision. Michael Becker is a former legal officer at the International Court of Justice. He says it's unlikely the court will throw out the case today, but may not go so far as ordering a ceasefire.
But I think there are real problems here for the court in terms of ordering a complete suspension of Israel's military activities, in part because the other party to that conflict, Hamas, isn't in front of the court. The court doesn't have any power to order Hamas to stand down.
And he doubts the court will ultimately find Israel guilty of genocide when the final ruling is handed down.
Proving genocide is extremely difficult under international law. So it's one thing to show that acts that could be characterized as genocidal acts have taken place. South Africa will be able to do that here. But showing that second part of the test, that Israel committed those acts, killing members of a particular group or deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about their destruction, to show that all of that was done with the intent to physically destroy the entire Palestinian population of Gaza, is going to be a difficult standard for South Africa to meet.
The interim ruling will be handed down amid reports Israeli soldiers have surrounded and fired upon a hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Israel insists it's only striking Hamas targets and that patients should have already evacuated the area. It's one of the last functioning hospitals in Gaza.
That's Angus Randall reporting there. Well, as Australia battles its own road toll, South Africa continues to make road safety headlines for all the wrong reasons. More than 1,400 people have been killed on South Africa's roads during the six-week Christmas New Year period. That's more than Australia's road toll for an entire year. South Africa has a population of around 62 million people, and its per capita road toll is more than five times higher than Australia. Dr. Lee Randall is a road safety researcher and co-founder of the Road Ethics Project in South Africa.
The vast majority of our people are in fact walking for most of their journeys, or at least part of their journeys. 41% of our deaths in a period like we've just come through are pedestrian deaths. You may be aware of our minibus taxi system, which carries around 70% of commuters in a city like Joburg. It's a profoundly unsafe system, privately owned, profit-oriented, drivers being exploited, working exceptionally long hours against the law, and quite often overloading their vehicles in order to maximize their earnings.
What about driver behaviour right across the board? I remember when I was living in South Africa, seeing very, very high speed, people driving at high speed, people following other cars very, very closely behind. What sort of factor is driver behaviour overall as well?
So the World Health Organization in December released its latest global status report on road safety and gave South Africa a great big red mark for our urban speed limits. So we have a distinct problem with driver behavior, but to a large extent, it's also governed by the types of roads that we have and the types of behaviors that have become condoned over the years. You may be aware we have a very high level of drink driving, of fatal crashes having alcohol implicated in some way.
Dr. Randall, we've been talking about road deaths, but also how significant is the social toll of road injuries, those people who are badly injured in some of these accidents?
It's hugely significant. I'm an occupational therapist, and so I've come into contact with crash survivors throughout my career. And the complete life-changing nature of many of the injuries is flabbergasting. The cost to society in human suffering, but also in direct medical and other costs.
Is it disproportionately people of colour in South Africa who are dying and being injured on the roads?
Yes. The Minister of Transport yesterday pointed out that it's mostly young African men who are dying and being injured on the roads. And remember, our population, African people make up the vast majority of the population. And even so, it is disproportionately high. And the typical figure that the World Health Organization puts out is that countries can lose anywhere from 3% to 10% of their GDP to road crashes. And it's such a preventable phenomenon.
And what about the compensation system? If someone has an accident, how much of a delay can there be sometimes in them getting assistance?
Well, I've never known such long delays as we're seeing now. I have one person on my books who was injured in 2016. Now, I've just been given his trial date, which is now set for 2027, so 11 years post-injury. yeah, the system is not working as it should be, and technically the Road Accident Fund is insolvent.
That's Dr. Lee Randall there, road safety researcher and co-founder of the Road Ethics Project in South Africa. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara. Stay safe.